Alright, this is probably just a personal recording. Although I intend to say some pretty astute stuff. That cocky to say. I mean, thanks for saying it was astute. You know, to be honest, I'm the first one to say it myself. I was reading an article this morning that was really quite, self-pandering, you know, writers writing about writers and getting it published as articles. And you're going, you know, this is a whole facade. You think anybody cares what you think. And you think that anything you care is just so amazingly laser-focused good enough to do. Well, you know what? It worked because I actually read a little bit of it before I just became so disgusted with this person. This person's upset because his basic thing is that he thinks self-publishing is diluting the reading the market. And he's, you know, and I didn't even get to the point of whether he really had a point as to whether we need to get rid of self-publishing because it puts too much text out there. And, you know, billions of, you know, books and books and books beyond any mere mortal's ability to read that much. And it was like, you know, and I think he was doing that because he said, you know what, it used to be a lot easier for me just to write something and then I could get it published. And it was like, oh, what? You know, and it's saying, so he, you know, this is a guy that would probably want government to step in and put in standards and stuff like that to try to shut out any kind of competition to what he does and what he was doing. So I found the whole thing. Okay, I'm going to have to do this again. Sometimes this system does not quite. I'm actually trying to get my stuff paid for. And this thing gets lost about where it is. And it says, there's no place near you. You know, you're too far away to do this. And it's like, I'm sitting right here next to it. So you have to kind of restart it. Anyway, yeah, and I just said, oh, from this guy about writing and about him saying that there's too much writing out there, and I say, so what? What exactly is your, what's the deal here? Am I full? Did I fill up last time? Take a look. I'm getting a little confused. Yep, I'm full. Okay. The transaction should be a couple of cents, which is a waste of time and effort, but there it is. What are you going to do? Oh. This has to do with so many things. People get upset because they said, you know what? Back in the old days, what I used to do made me a lot of money and a lot of fame. And I would run into people. They would go, hey, you're that guy who did this and that. And oh, my gosh, I just love what you write. And you know, ego stroking beyond all belief. And so these guys think that it's something about them. And typically, it has to do with, now, in the past, there has been what I guess, for lack of a better term, called text scarcity. On some level, it was hard to get text. That's where libraries came from, was what was ultimately seen as text scarcity. the cost of books was out of reach of most people. A lot of people found that it was some kind of interesting civic duty to set up a place that was going to be resourced enough to buy books, and that was its purpose. And this was a real boon for a lot of people to be able to go to what originally have been called a lending library. Back in the old days, there were private libraries, and you could pay a little bit, you know, and you could check out books and then bring them back and get another book and do stuff like that. That was kind of the idea of libraries. Can I be honest? Libraries by and large are now dead. The only reason why you visit a library today is because another somewhat unnecessary institution tells you that you have to in order to get a certain grade that's pretty much it, to get a certain grade. You know, most libraries are now used by school kids for the sole reason of saying, he told me I needed to go in here and get a book. It was all about trying to learn how to use a library. And now most of those old library uses are just obfuscated. As more and more people are able to connect themselves to the internet, the whole point of libraries is almost dead. You know, when there are bond elections in the old days, I used to do the bonds for more stuff for libraries. And, I wouldn't do it for anything else because I have this weird problem with schools. Schools are just little busy factories creating jobs for teachers and it says it actually does have a function for the very neediest of humans. Gives them a place to go, gives them work to do. It's kind of like the old poor person's workhouse is what school is now. You know, we used to call it prison. Now I just call it the workhouse. If you're poor and you have nothing else to do, you go to school. And they will put you to work doing who knows what. It's a big, huge work program. People who can't figure out anything better to do. The sad part is everybody is either supposed to go there or come up with a vaguely intricate plan that is supposed to somehow replace that. You go, no, this is, you should just let people who don't want to be there not be there. But, you know, my first great thing about saying, if there was one rule that would change the world for the better in amazing ways, well, this comes from a guy that didn't need school. School wasn't necessary for me. You know, when people go, oh, I love school. School's just so wonderful. No, and those are mostly the people that become your state legislators for education, is people who loved school. You know, and you go, I do better just going out and gaining the certifications I need. One of the big reasons for school is to gain certification, but it doesn't let you just gain it. You have to go through a whole long, stupid kind of keep you busy program. And then at the very end, they will stamp you on the back of your hand and say, you're certified to behave as a human being, which I think is hilarious because they don't even teach anything about that anymore. And they say, you know, we're going to teach school success, which I think is hilarious because it's like, I don't need to be a success in school. What's that going to buy me? Oh, most teachers are people who really bought into school success. I'm really helping people. This is really going to help you when you're in high school. And you go, you know what? You're going to only be in high school for 4 years, and then you're finally going to get out of that. And guess what? The 80 years after that, or 70 years after that, have very little to do with what you did during those 4 years that you prepared so hard for, that were so vital, and you're going, you know what, that's garbage. And I learned that as a when I went to go teach. And you have to understand, I've got all this stuff in my head, so I did not drink the Kool-Aid. And somebody said, you know why you're such a bad teacher? Because you didn't do student teaching. And you're going, yeah, I says, I'm guessing that's where you inject me with some kind of weird chemical, or I have to drink some kind of weird Kool-Aid that only gets made in, like, student teacher lounges. You know, smoke those wacky cigarettes that those guys smoke in the teacher's lounge. And I don't know. Like, maybe it's something like that. But anyway, this guy talking about his thing was all about preserving his personal economy by smashing other people out of it, was what I kind of started getting into it. I didn't read the whole thing. I'm sure he'd come back and say, that's not what I meant at all. You're making me out as some narcissistic jerk. And I go, it's because I think you are. Just speaking about this subject indicates, number one, you don't really get what's going on. You have come to what was once an information poor place, and you made money packaging up information. It may have been in a good way or a cute way or an enticing way, whatever, and you were making your occupation off that. I said, I'm sorry. This kind of stuff is predominantly no longer can be an occupation because it's just too easy for people to do it themselves. I really think education is going down that road too. And I think education's a big misused word about it. It's schooling. Schooling is going to go out of style because we don't need basically teachers. We don't need them. We can teach ourselves. We can learn for ourselves. And then if we feel the need to validate that we understand something or stuff like that, we can go and get a certification. Teachers hate that because it's like, well, then you don't need me. And you go, yeah, have you figured out yet? You don't have a real life profession anymore. You guys are mostly, you know, most of the teaching profession spends most of its time propping up the teaching profession and telling everybody how fantastic they are, how wonderful they are, how altruistic they are. You know, first they're saying, look at all this stuff I do and I don't do it for a lot of money. And then they turn around immediately and start screaming about the fact that they're worth more. And you're going, these guys are hilarious. Depends on who they think they're talking to as to what they're wanting to say. You need to pay me more. And you go, no. Fact, I'm kind of getting upset that you keep sequestering my child and saying that it's your right to do it. It's your duty. And if I don't let you very expensively goof around with my child, I should go to jail for truancy. You go, you know what? I'm sorry. It wasn't interesting in the past, and it's certainly less interesting now. I just passed along to my church group that one of the school districts has decided to, I don't know if they got the contract with the state or what, because, you know, half of states are all about education. That's where the bulk of their money comes in. That's where the bulk of their money comes out. It justifies three-quarters of their existence. Writing as a profession, I don't think is going to last very long. Although, you know, it has more to do with famous people trying to capitalize a little more on their fame, so they write a book. And you have to understand that book writing is very much, in fact, has more to do with that than any kind of prowess or skill that has to do with writing. And you can say, oh, well, you just don't understand writing. You don't write much professionally. And you go, no, I don't. It says, I am published, though. It says, so I don't think I'm too bad of a writer. I don't think I come up with bad writing projects. But I said, is it ever going to be, I can write enough that I'm going to get, you know, that I'm going to be able to do that as my method of making money and eating from day to day? And it's like, most, absolutely not. Most people cannot do that, you know. And they go, what about J.K. Rowling? And you go, interesting intersection of an idea, a concept, somebody willing to write it and put it out there. Interesting thing. And you go, oh, well, she's the richest, one of the richest women in England. And you go, and that's exactly what the quote writing industry, there is a whole industry of people that actually make money trying to teach you how to be a best-selling author. And there's you know, and it got sunk into college, too. I'm taking a creative writing program at a college, and it will show me how to write the great novel, or the great novel set in the case of, like, Rowling, who means that she never has to do anything ever again. Except, you know, take the occasional speaking role to say, oh, isn't this wonderful? And I used to want, you know, I used to picture myself as being that kind of a person. And to be honest, I may have been able to cultivate it, but over time I just said, you know what, I was trying to get it done on the side of feeding my family, and it finally became the whole thing. Well, what is all this supposed to accomplish? And you go, well, it's supposed to feed your family. And you're going, I already am feeding my family. You go, okay, well, then don't worry about the rest. I think there are a lot of things that are going this. I think the vast majority of people that make money with computers, a lot of that's probably going to, you know, morph over to whatever kind of AI there is, which I think is kind of silly. People think these things are thinking, and you go, no, they don't. They just collect a lot of stuff, and they compare it to a lot of writing, and they put in structure and syntax, which is kind of the scientific way of writing. And that's it, you know. It's mostly what a whole lot of people used to do. Repackage information that was already out there. A little cherry on top. And there was plenty of people that was how they made money writing. And sadly, they started looking at a lot of things, and they said, how formulaic is our most novels today? The publishers themselves made it that way by simply making a formula, because as soon as you make that formula, It's something that can be rendered into an algorithm. And when you render it into an algorithm, basically, a 5,000 monkeys computer, that's what the large language model is. 5,000 monkeys writing Shakespeare. And that's what happens. Well, we've studied Shakespeare, we've broken it down into the little pieces of how he used to, what his process was, and we can have the large language model, ChatGPT, whatever, we can have them generate the whole thing. It was like the old day of doing essays. I used to tutor people on doing essays. Not that I was a really good essay writer, but I knew the formula, you know, the whole lead in, then you do three paragraphs or three points in the subject you're talking about, then you make your point, and then you do the outro. And you go, that's formulaic. And you go, yeah, this is, essays can be knocked out easily. And there are people who say, oh, well, I'm just an expert at doing essays. And you go, well, that's great. This is good for you. My present thing is build up, dump that load and leave it, you know. It's kind of like the homeless guy on the sidewalk. I'm walking around. I'm churning up whatever garbage in my gut that I was able to slip down it. I get that done. I squat down. I poop it out. And then I walk away, and then I kind of hope that somebody's going to come and look at what I pooped, and go, huh. All right. And some of my poopings have gotten quite some play, you know. Maybe upwards of 1,000 people have read it over years. Come on, get serious. So it's kind of like poop that doesn't really break down, decompose. It just keeps sitting there and smelling bad. And hopefully people will notice it. And that's kind of how, that's what my instead of essay writing, you know, I used to call it essays, and I guess I still do, but they don't have the form of an essay. Because to be honest, you don't really have to write that formula unless you're actually going to write to a literary magazine who says, you better do it this way. It's like saying, you know, I write haiku, and you go, well, you have to understand what a haiku is and how it's done. And you have to follow that form if you expect to put it in a haiku book or out there where haikus are, because people will catch on fast and start saying, you don't do haikus. That's why I don't try to market my stuff as essays so much anymore. It's just taking a dump. It's big dumps, as Donald Trump would say. Everybody goes out and they do big dumps. And you go, that's me. Man, I just do a dump. Something comes to my head, and then I turn it around just a little, because frankly I got too much turning around, and then I dump it. And so that's where that is. So they go, well, that's why you have no respect for the industry. And you're going, you're probably right. He says, you know, I've written things that could probably, I've written books that probably would be publishable. Most of them aren't long enough. A novel needs to be about, 300 pages these days. The really good selling ones are much longer, because people really want to get wrapped in a huge story that lasts a while. That's kind of the tendency that a lot of readers are going in. That's where it comes Harry Potter. You can sit there and say, oh, it's seven or six or seven, eight different books. And you go, nah, you know, it really ends up just being kind of an episodic thing. Most people who say, oh, I remember the great books of the past. And you go, you do know that they weren't written as books in the past. They were written more as little magazine stories, And then they were stitched together into books. And that's where you get that. It says, you know, the really sad part is you guys talk about your form and your format and how amazing it is and how much of a storied history it has. When you go back and you go, you know what? That's not its history at all. They didn't write the entire thing in like one sitting and put it out there. Most of them were writing for money. And magazines were how you mostly sold. And you sold by the word. You didn't want to be succinct. You wanted to be really wordy. You know, big, huge word descriptions of a field and all the little poppies and this and that and this and that. And people said, oh, this is the way you write. And you go, that's the way you write when you're trying to fill up space. And you're paid by the word. That's how it works. And you go, so yeah. It says, you still have to say something interesting because otherwise they aren't going to come back next time and ask you to write. There was this one article written by Scott Adams, and he talked about all this, and he kind of uncovered most of the garbage about it. And in doing so, he came up with a very engaging article. Good job, Scott Adams. Did they ever ask him to write for them again? No. And they never will. Why? Because he broke the cardinal rule. Don't tell people that this is all just mostly a weird game that we play. And that we say, you know, and we all puff ourselves up with how wonderful we are, amazingly brilliant we are, or stuff like that. And you go, and it's all mostly just a bunch of buddies that got together and figured out a way to get this to happen. And now are just going around self-congratulating each other. And, yeah. And you go, it was mostly, I'm sorry, I will use a crass term, bullshit. It's mostly a bunch of bullshitting. And, people kind of got into the, and said, hey man, I can bullshit a little bit better than they can. And that became the publishing industry. That's how you got this published. They get upset at self-publishing now because anybody can write down anything at all, and they all try to compare what they do with what other people do and say, this is why I'm a published author, which means something. Other people publish me, and you go, yeah, because you're their buddy and you went to the soirees, and those guys usually find people to write for them who are perfectly willing to sleep on other people's couches for years on end. And put together books. And it's absolutely stunning. It's like, oh my gosh, this is the goofiest thing, you know? Or you've accomplished something else in some other field. Somebody says you need to write a book about it. Those are often useful because they may have useful information in them. But most of the time people buy them because they want to become like that person. And reading about them may be the closest they ever get to them. And that may have been what I was doing, you know. It was like, you know, do I know how to program? Yes. This is, yeah, I've got a program out on the web right now. And people go, well, it's not very impressive. And you go, it doesn't matter. It says, if you looked at the internal way that it works, you'd go, wow, that's very elegant. That's very cool. Now, do I want to do that every day? No. Because it is a whole lot of pressure cooker, boilerplate work. You know, it's mostly just junk and stuff that you probably wouldn't be terribly proud of. It's mostly taking what other people have already written. There's very little original programming that gets done now. Almost everything has already been done. You're either translating it from one antique language over to something a little more modern. That's what a lot of people do, is they make conversions from old to new, and then they have to go through and clean up all the stuff, and it's an absolute rat's nest mess of just junk. You know, and then you spend your days trying to do quote support of that stuff, which is basically just keeping it running. When people throw inputs in it that don't make sense, the biggest thing it has to do is be able to process that input anyway and do something intelligent with it. Anyway, that's where prompt engineers come in. These are people that actually spend their time translating garbage into something that can be processed. And they're supposed to be, quote, teaching a computer how to do this. If you see this, do this. If you see this, do that. And what is it? It's programming. And you go, yeah. And you go, is it any different programming than I did on BASIC when I was a kid, when I came up with this thing? And I did, I really kind of liked, what do you call it? I really kind of liked adventure games. Adventure games are mostly going to rooms, solving puzzles. I wasn't really good at solving the puzzles. Collecting this item and that item to do this and that later on in other places. The old adventure games were kind of like this. And the very first one was made out of a guy who was a spelunker. He wasn't a programmer. And he drew out a cave system that he was familiar with. Those became all the places you could go and all the things you could do. And it became this game, and it got through this whole thing. It was like he was taking individual people or groups, spelunking with him virtually. It was virtual spelunking. Still is, basically. But can I be really honest? It's pretty much died. Even those people that do a really good job and everybody says, ooh, I really like that thing. There's no money in it. He can't do it. Back in the days, that's kind of what happened. The first guy did it. He just gave it to the world, didn't make any money at it. It was just something that he did for fun. And a lot of people got into it. And then a couple of other people said, hey, wait a minute. I think I'm gonna either take this idea or actually take the thing that he did and turn this into a product that I can sell. And that's what happened. That was what's called Zork. And it was something. Anyway, I played a few of them, but I found out that I didn't enjoy playing them half as much as I enjoy trying to think through now how would I rig something like that. And I ultimately put together, I got tired of all the drawing and coming up with different rooms, trying to make them interesting and things like that. I just rigged up an algorithm to create a space that you could travel through. It would have, you know, in most times you'd actually set up rooms and then you would put passages between the rooms. You have to put a passage to another room. If you want to be able to go back and forth between the rooms, instead of being like some slamming door that never lets you back out the other way, you would have to put another exit going back the other way. I had rigged it a certain way. People had all worked out. It was the very interesting thing is they actually made these things called MUDs, and it was a multi-user dungeon, and so multiple people could come into these places, and it had a social aspect. You could go and you could talk to people in there. You could put on different personas and play different games. stuff like that. And you guys could actually travel through a cave as a spelunking group. And it was all done, you all sat your individual terminals, and you could spelunk together. That was mostly what that was. Mine was kind of like mine was different in that it just created this whole feel. And it's not unique. I don't think I was the first one to come up with it. And you could treat it that way if you wanted to, but it was really more of the concept of having walls or fences or stuff like that that could be strong. There was barriers between certain areas and others, and you would have to work your way around the barriers. It's more like a maze where, like I said, these other things were more like spelunking in caves. And there was rooms and there was passageways between rooms. Ta-da! And so it was very different, although it kind of got glommed together. People who were thinking along one line would get upset with another way of doing it that said it was going to be this other way. And of course, it was made a little difficult because your algorithm needed to take into account distances, you know, because it isn't that you would just see where you were. You could see all around you, and you can see a large distance away, and how you would do that eventually got really cumbersome, and I really stopped doing it because it wasn't really, you know, it was really something that lended itself to what like Minecraft became. You could see blocks further out if you were at a certain perspective. And that's where that stuff came from. You could go there and then you'd say, oh, there's something there. Let me go and pick that up. And I need that later. And I think that all happened, but I had kind of thunk it up from the first exposure to virtual cave spelunking. And that's what a whole lot of the adventure games from the time that I was interested in that stuff. That was what that came from. Everything was cave spelunking. You really often just couldn't see beyond what somebody wanted you to see in a particular situation. So you had to draw out everything. You could still do it my way, which was a plane with a whole bunch of what were practically squares. They were diamonds when you looked at them. And you basically moved in different directions. Go places. You know. Anyway. But yeah, was it something that was ever going to make money? And you go, maybe, but probably not. Because it wasn't compelling beyond something else. Right now, we have information overload. Everybody thought that there was going to be tons and tons of money made for people that could take this huge ball of information and chunk it up into little pieces that would be useful to people, and they would pay for that. Well, that's what AI has become, is the thing that says I can sort through all this information, you know, and they go, well, yeah. And, you know, using keywords or search criteria, stuff like that. The big thing now is that you can just tell it what you want to know. And it'll tell you. The only problem is you really have to craft how you ask the question. And that's hard. It might actually improve people's language in that they have to speak properly to get the kind of information they would like out of the huge general mishmash of information that's out there. The only problem is it's going to start feeding upon itself. You know, a whole lot of information that it's going to be trying to cull is pre-culled information from other sources. Back in the old days, we didn't have to worry about it too much because there really wasn't a lot of this out there and going on, and you didn't have to worry about how much recycling was going on. Now we're taking it to a whole nother level, and it's very possible soon that you're going to be sucked into these weird informational infinite loops that don't really get you anywhere, and that say basically the same thing to you, just regurgitated in a different way, but then something else consumes that regurgitation, chunks it up, stirs it around, and regurgitates it again, and you're going, you know. I think that's what people say when there's like, well, we feed the same information into the model two or three times, and we get really radically different things back from it. You go, yeah, you are actually getting vomit. Can I tell you? Yeah. You know, when I say my big thing is I get this idea, I turn it around, and then I poop it out and leave it on the sidewalk and see how many people look at it. It says, now what we've got is AI, which is something coming along behind me, perhaps, scooping up that poop, churning it around again, and pooping it out again. Except that it's kind of for money. It said, and they found out that it's a whole lot cheaper to just scoop up poop and re-regurgitate it than it is to come up with new content. Computers are absolutely crappy at new content. And they don't do, you know, everybody says, oh, it's going to be great when it does interpretation. It can take in a lot of data and interpret it for us. You go, no, it doesn't mostly do that. All it does is it takes that stuff in, churns it around, poops it out, and probably the important thing to get out of that is when people study the poop and say, I think I'm seeing a pattern here, you know. And then those guys say, well, that's what happens. That guy says that, he's pooping that out, and so the pooper scoopers come in, and they pick all that up, they turn it around, they poop it back out, and you get all this weird stuff, and it goes, you know, anybody who's ever talked about misinformation or disinformation is kind of talking about a purposeful, what I'm talking about, the constant sucking in, churning, regurgitating process. On everything. Most inane, stupid, dumb ideas get the same process done. It might go through a couple of iterations, going out to different places and trying to get stuff. And then saying, okay, I've heard this idea three times. I've only heard this idea two times. I'm throwing out the two times one and going with the three times one. Is that how one determines truth? No. That's how one determines what's kind of popular. And they go, well, if it's popular, it's probably true. And you go, that is a whole lot of what this stuff is. AI does that kind of algorithmic calculation. I used to kind of do that too. I understand this a little bit because I'm autistic and autistic people tend to systematize things very hard and try to figure out almost an algorithmic reason to explain why things are. And that's why we don't function well in society, because it doesn't really work. And yeah, it's like, wow, what are we producing? Big autistic people, everybody says you should be listening to this. And you're going, dude, I'm sorry. I'm one of these people. And the first thing you should probably do is discount what we say. And people do, because that's just what they do. Whether it's smart or not, who knows? Things like that. So it was really interesting seeing this guy decrying the fact that he doesn't make as much money as he used to, and decrying the fact that there's too much stuff out there. And to be honest, I think it's that he's mostly upset that readers aren't discriminating enough to walk up to him. Always go to him and say, oh, I need to keep throwing money at him and reading him because he's so much better than everybody else. I think that was kind of what he was going for. He might have been self-deprecating at the end to try to not look like such a self-aggrandizing, look at me kind of guy. Aren't I great? Sort of a guy. He would discount that after he had mostly set up the thing saying, don't you guys trust the old gatekeepers that mostly gave me strokes and told me how wonderful I am and how smart and how important what I said was, important enough to go out and publish a book about it? You know, you're going, that's mostly publishers. It says, and they were mostly doing it for their friends and relations and turning it into money. Says now it's harder to turn it into money. So it's become kind of a business where you go, oh, I don't do a lot of business that way. You know, there isn't so much of a market for that as there used to be, because people used to look at that and say, oh, this is knowledge. You know, and they would snap it up because they thought it would make them a better person or that they would enjoy it more. It was so funny. And it really didn't do anything. Like, let me drop a name for you. This is a name that was big in the late 70s. Irma Bombeck. She was kind of an essayist about normal life. She was this mom and homemaker. And she was funny. She found the humor in homemaking and mothering to a large extent. And she was doing that, you know. Today, if she was going to be doing it and get any kind of success at all, she'd be a stand-up comic. Right now, there are a number of women that do what she did, but as stand-up comedy, because that's how you do it now. You aren't going to make money writing a book about it. Another example of that. Oh, Robert Foljam. He was, you know, I think it would probably like be the early 80s. Robert Foljam became this guy. He wrote this little itty book called Everything I Ever Needed to Know in Life I Learned in Kindergarten. And that caught fire. And it made him a lot of money. He got on the lecture circuit. Everybody whined and dined him. He would get up and rattle on and on. He had this interesting, he had this interesting vocal pattern. And he was featured on, he was kind of, I guess everybody thought he was a folk intellectual. And all of the other intellectuals wined and dined him because he was popular for a little bit, for about, I don't know, 20, 25 minutes. He published at least two books that I'm aware of. The first one was popular. The second one was like, an obligatory, I've got a 3-book deal with a publishing company. And he did his second book. And I'm sure he did the third one too. And those two hardly sold anything at all, although they really ramped it up. And there was still some cachet for saying it was Robert Fulghum's next book. And wasn't it going to be just as amazing as everything I ever learned in life I learned in kindergarten? It was better. It was better. It was a better statement. I said it right, I think, before. Anyway. And it was all about that. So yeah, he was on NPR. He kind of became a person, one of their audio essayists on National Public Radio, which was kind of a thing. I don't know how often they still do that. It was something that was supposed to really, really, I'm having to keep getting out of the sun. The time I'm trying to do my stuff, the sun's in my face. Boy, if I could be on the other side of Cannon Air Force Base, I would have a wonderful life. I'd have the sun behind me, going to work, and the sun in front of me going back. Whenever I traveled for work between Tucumcari and Albuquerque, that was great because that was exactly how it went. You know, the sun was behind me the whole time, and it's pretty easy to block out what's behind you. Or I would go home late enough that it would already have been dark. The sun would already be down. It wouldn't matter anyway. Anyway, so here I am. Doesn't really matter. These people got this wonderful thing about how wonderful I am. They may still be on the circuit, but now it's kind of like, who was this guy? And then you say his book, and increasingly now it's people who said, I've never heard of that book. And you go, that's how much it mattered. It was one of those little cocktail books that you put on your cocktail table to tell how really intellectual you were because you were hanging out with this folk intellectual. And there's been others of them. I forget which ones. Tom Baudet was a folk intellectual. And he, you know, and what these people really, really end up trying to do to keep that money flowing is that they take that little bit of fame and they morph it into a job being like a game show host or, you know, hosting something else on other types of media. And they don't really have to have snippets anymore. They can just do that. Storyteller, the biggest folk intellectual storyteller was Garrison Keillor. He was the guy that did the Prairie Home Companion radio program for a long, long time. I remember I first heard it probably within the first 5 years of its creation, and I listened to it a lot. You know, it was on every... In my town, it was on every Saturday afternoon, and it was fun because I kind of liked it, you know. And things changed, and I had other things to do at the time that it was on, or it was moved to a different place, or it was no longer on my NPR radio station, or I just stopped listening to NPR altogether. My wife finally said, "Okay, enough of that." And it's like, okay. She got tired of it. We started doing something else. We started reading. We started reading for a while. And that was fun. And, it's much more fun than listening to this guy. And, you know, and I'm sorry. Some of the stuff gets kind of old. His stories got a little bit old. He would try to punch up and freshen them up. But that would kind of lost me when it kind of got about, he was trying to get all, diverse, and he was trying to tell stories that were supposed to feel good to quote intellectuals, and I use quote pretty hard because that is the first group of people that really like to have people tell them how amazing they are. Everybody wants to be a college professor, to have a whole room full of bright, young, nubile, to be honest, nubile students hanging on their every word, mostly because you're going to give them a test later on it, as if what you're saying makes any difference. And, or is even honestly true. And it's hard to say, you know, I used to teach this 20 years ago and I don't teach it the same way I taught it 20 years ago because I lied to you before and now I'm telling you the truth. And you're going, well, I'm not sure, we could just, you know, and we all get weird about saying, well, we don't call that a lie. We just say we didn't know. Our knowledge and our perspective has evolved. And you go, yeah, that is a really nice way of saying I was wrong before. I'm probably wrong now. And what I tell you 20 years from now is also probably going to be wrong. But you're still going to pay me for the privilege of me telling you basically what I think is probably right, given the information I have, which I'm not very smart. You know, I went to school for 4 years. I went to college for 4 years. I went and I got my PhD. That's about four or five more years. And now I get to talk to you as if I'm an expert on this, and you have to listen to what I say. And if you don't listen properly to what I say, I get to grade you down. And you fail to perform, therefore you will always listen with rapt attention to what I say. This is the intelligentsia. And, you know, and they kind of wrap around each other, you know. They all listen to public radio, and they all have the same basic ideas. Because they get to self-certify themselves, you know, The way you get to be a doctor of philosophy is you get other doctors of philosophy to say you're a doctor of philosophy. So that is a very easy formula for creating these ivory towers of ideology. We all think the same way. And you go, well, how does that happen? You go, because we don't certify people that don't think the way we think. Because we know what we're talking about. We're smart. And the only way you can get that smart label is to think and talk and behave the same way we do and go to the same faculty parties we do. And so since I am not really a guy that's interested in those kinds of games, that I feel like are games, instead of going out and really coming up with something interesting, getting a new perspective on things that might help people do something different, that's really not what intelligentsia is for. That's not how they build the group. The most important thing is to build up your own personal school of scholars that basically say what you say and do your program, and your immortality is to say, well, Jason's school of philosophy still exists today. And you go, that's their immortality. And they sit there and they study all the stuff I've ever said or all I've ever written, and say, you know, how brilliant he is, how wonderful that is. And, you know, at some point they just keep saying that, as opposed to them saying, you know what, I think he was full of a bunch of bupkis because he didn't know what the heck he was talking about. So nobody goes to his school anymore, and nobody can make money at it, so they've all come up with their own things. Although most schools of this or that or this or that are a repackaging and expansion of what's done in the past. Everybody says, oh, we don't like Freud. Freud was a jerk, you know, in psychology. Psychology didn't used to be a thing. It actually broke away from other kinds of thinking. Science, same way. The whole university endeavor used to be just one thing about trying to teach a certain number of skills, and then it exploded into what it is now. And of course, now it just specializes into, okay, there's different schools that do different things. I go to a community college because I want to learn actual skills. And you're going, you know, you don't even have to go to a school to learn this skill. Just go and apprentice yourself. I'm in air quotes. All you have to do is work with somebody. He probably wants somebody to do some of the gut work he doesn't want to do anymore, the master now, and that's what he'll put you to doing is sweeping up after him, and you can take smaller scale work that isn't as precise and good, and that's, you know, that has been killed off because everybody wanted to support going to college because that makes everybody feel better. You are now smarter because you went to college among other smart people, as if smartness was something you could rub off on somebody else. Very little of what you have you can give to somebody else, even through writing, for instance. All you can do is create some kind of weird ideology, and you can force other people to obey that ideology by saying that doing this makes you rich, or doing this makes you popular, or doing this makes you erudite. You know, and so when they go, well, how come Nemro does the things that he does? And he goes, because I don't take much stock in all that stuff. I see through you. And of course they will say, you don't understand what I do at all. What I do is intricate and difficult and important. And you go, you guys may have wrapped crap around yourself so it looks that way. But at the end of the day, it's just a system and an ideology and mostly a thing trying to get rid of competition. That was what this guy talking about what he does as a writer. He was trying to tell everybody that they didn't need to bother competing with him. He understands how this works. And you go, it's just a made-up system of how it works. Some of it was like in, well, you know, you have to lay out the text. You have to print out thousands of copies of it. And then you have to put them into situations where they're going to sell. And you go, yeah, but I can do the same thing with Bubba's field guide to fishing with beer, and you find out that is just as interesting as your intelligentsia writing. In fact, more so, and you kind of feel like, you know, and then you get upset because, well, that's that gross novelty press, you know, and you go, it's the same system you're using that you say you deserve people's accolades for being a person that can do this when Joe Schmo with a laser printer can do it now. Regardless. It's a funny world. Most of my books don't sell, and you go, yeah, there's a good reason why they don't sell. And his accusation was there's too many books. Your book can't be found in the absolute flood of books out there. And he was decrying, I don't know if he got around to decrying it. I imagine that he might have. It's all about marketing. It's all about having the right cover on your book. It's all about it being the right width and the right size so that it's it's at least not offensive or something. In the old days, you didn't have to worry. If you actually wrote something, it would automatically be something somebody wanted to read because so few people had the time or went through the effort to write a book. Now, there's so much playtime around. Everybody writes a book. Five neighbors, you know, it used to be, well, I've written six books. And you go, you know, and my college president at the last college job I had, he thought that was impressive. And you go, have you read any of them? You go, no. He says, well, then how can you say it's impressive? Well, somebody published them, and you go, no, I self-published most of them. Only once or twice have I had literary magazines pick up a couple of my short stories. It says, and I don't really write very many short stories. I says, you know, I mostly write essays because that's really what I have. To be honest, that's really all I have time for, you know. Although I do have a fictional writing style that's very much, it doesn't have to be blocked out really hard. Anyway, so Lisa and I are reading one of my books now. My first novel, the early one, first called Queensryche, but I got rid of that one because there was a heavy metal rock band that got that name. It wasn't anything really that big, but it made it so I didn't want to use that title anymore. It might be good for me to have used that title because then somebody might have thought I did kind of an anthology of a heavy metal rock group, and I would have tricked them into buying my book and reading it. Because most people will buy a book just based on what's on the cover, read it until they stop, either at the end because it was interesting enough to keep them reading it, or until they just decide that it wasn't what they had thought it was going to be. The science of book selling is trickery. It's getting you to buy something under the guise of it probably being something else. What we call today clickbait, when you're going to watch a video or look at an article and you go, oh, that sounds interesting. And then you go through it and you go, you know what? I even think they actually mentioned what the title is. Because it's clickbait. Mostly done by a publisher, whoever that publisher is, to try to get you to watch, read, listen to, whatever, a product. Books, you couldn't do it too much because there were actually laws that said that you were being deceitful. There's so much of it now mixed in with everything else, you can't get anybody for deceit because it's really not worth the effort. You really have to make it worth some lawyer's time to put in this kind of stuff. And we've really figured out that you don't do that. Luckily, videos are only 15, 20 minutes usually. Some of them far less, some of them far more. And I was to the base already about that. Dun, 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 dun. All right. Okay. So, yeah, like I said, so being smart, well, I don't know if it's even being smart, being whatever it is I am, means that I can see that almost everything is kind of a trick. Getting money out of another person, a lot of it is basically repackaging. Whatever. Farming used to be pretty pure. You know, farming, ranching, stuff like that. Actually pulling pulling food out of ground and effort and seed was pretty honest work. And anybody who did that would mostly work, look at other things and say that they were, that was pretty honest work too. And you go, oh wow. No, it's mostly just trying to talk people into doing something and making sure they know and screaming at somebody to get them to buy something. Coming up with a way that it's supposed to make people, I don't know, more fulfilled, happy, entertain them. That's probably the biggest thing, is how much raw money we spend on entertainment or the production of entertainment, and hoping other people will see it as entertaining. The really sad part is far more people would like to make that a going occupation for themselves, a business for lack of a better term, than that people have time to consume this stuff at scale. You know, that's always what people say. You want to do something that can scale. And you got to understand that most real things don't scale. Farming, when you attempt to do farming at scale, it really becomes far more dangerous of an occupation. You acquire millions of dollars worth of equipment so that you can farm thousands of acres of land. The kind of things that you grow, the only thing that makes sense to grow are things that are very extremely profitable when you're using million-dollar equipment to make it happen. It usually isn't stuff that's well suited to your area, therefore you just, you know, you bring in stuff that you shouldn't have there. You have to bring in fertilizer to build up your soil that you don't have. And water, and you have to haul in water that you don't have to sprinkle all over something, because you're actually growing a crop that really needs to grow someplace else. It happens around here, right? Here we have a lot of pivot irrigation. They go round and round in a circle and just rain on stuff. And that's part of the problem, is they never figured out how to raise anything here that was palatable to markets, that scaled. And you go, yeah, this is, can I be honest? Farming in and of itself is scalable. You have to turn it into something almost manufactured for it to be scalable. You know, dump, you know, it really has nothing to do with the actual land you're on. You could be, your field could be gravel with no dirt in it at all, but they can spray enough fertilizer, water it enough, and do all this other stuff that it doesn't really matter. You know? It's like you're doing virtually hydroponics out in your field. And you're going, wow. The only problem is you can only do that with crops that really make a ton of money, because that's the only way you can justify all that stuff. That's why I say farming basically failed in my part of the country, because they couldn't scale. The only thing they can grow here is really low quality alfalfa or grain that gets baled up and fed to cows. It's not worth a lot because the cows have to eat a ton of it to get much nutrition out of it. The stuff that grows here by nature isn't very nutritious. Not compared to the grasses grown, in Kentucky. Can't compete against Kentucky at all. It isn't just how much grass you have, it's how many nutrients are in the grass. And for the most part, it's just junk. So anyway, okay. Well, I'm almost to my destination. I need to stop.